Good morning, everyone. Excited for another session of 99 Dev Problems. I keep saying another, and I feel like I need to change my intro because it's like, it almost feels like another is not a good thing when I'm like, yes, another amazing conversation. Super pumped to chat with Matt this morning. Matt, I would love for you to introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Matt. So at the moment, I'm the founder of PureType. This is EdTech for developer product I'm working on. Before that, I was a CTO at a fintech firm called Tellurium that did energy trading. And before even that, I was the CTO of a hedge fund that did high frequency, medium frequency trading. I've always been interested in programming and computers and software development since I was 12. I wrote my own operating system when I was a teenager, used some of that for my final year project at university. So there's plenty to dive into today, hopefully. And obviously, had successes and failures along the way. It'd be great to pick through that and see what we can find.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, you wrote your own operating system. That's like, yes, we all have like had video game classes, or we all had like early programming classes or whatever, but like your own operating system, we have to dive into that. Why an operating system, and like, what did you build? Tell me more.
So I think I came in with that engineer mindset, the sense of, you can't really understand something until you really pick it apart and build it. And so, yeah, I got started with games. It was nice cloning games like Pong and trying to come up with your own things. That was in a language called Blitz Basic, so a form of BASIC. But what I think I really tried to dive into was, well, why do things have to be this way? Can we build it a different way and experiment with that? So you can get started with operating systems by writing the bootloader. So you have to fit a whole ton of stuff into 512 bytes. But once you get to that stage, you kind of think, okay, well, there's actually a whole bunch of different routes that you can go. And what I managed to do was just really work on it, you know, try and break down all of the problems, try to get it to do something cool that I know that few other people have done. And of course, if you keep going along that timeline, then you can load stuff from disk and get that going. But you get to a point where I got like basic USB devices working. That's kind of cool. Yeah. And then for my university final year project, I had to write a thesis. I was a bachelor's, so it wasn't as deep as master's thesis, but it was still a couple of, 100 pages plus. And what I wanted to do was take one of the ideas from the Linux kernel, this idea of how do we make networking faster? If we want to make a really, really fast network traffic, what are the things that actually stop tons and tons of data flow? That the unnecessary steps that we have, or ways to reduce the complexity of sending and receiving tons of data. So I wrote the idea, I put it into my operating system, and you could end up sending, like with Telnet and all those kind of basic TCP programs, you could send the data, copy the data in user space, like set a flag, and then the network card would go and send off the data. That was cool. I remember sitting and coding that for like 30 days straight, writing the thesis in like another 20 days straight. But it was great. Yeah, it's that kind of purest form of engineering there is. You have a good idea, you have a certain amount of time to do it, and you just figure out how to make it work. And of course, the rush that we all go for is, oh, cool. You know, this all of this stuff together, all of these hurdles that I've had to overcome, but I've got to this point where, you know, I can actually go and send this piece of data and, of course, receive, something. So you could connect to this Telnet server and it would give you the first bit of Star Wars as a sort of ASCII art diagram. It was kind of cool to see that running on something that you've built from the ground
up. Oh, man.
So I was lucky to have that.
That is so stinking cool. Like, I think there's been a few conversations back and forth, I've had a variety of different guests on. But I think what's like really been so near and dear to my heart lately is like having really good conversations about understanding system architecture, like really, truly getting every bit of what you're building from top all the way down and, bringing in a framework that you actually deeply understand versus bringing in a framework you're not familiar with. You tell that story so beautifully, right? Like you went all the way down to the root of building your own system at which then you would build software upon. That's the deepest level of meta I think you could possibly get when it comes to that. How cool is that? Yeah, that's really neat.
It's an approach to things, you know. It's and I think this applies outside of software engineering. Should I do stuff because someone else tells me that that's the right way to go, or try and pick apart, well, how do they get to that thinking? What's the kind of principles that were they kept in mind while they were doing that? And you know, what can I do that if it's a slightly different situation, what kind of principles can I apply there too? So I found that it's really you know, writing your own OS is a pretty thankless job, but the lessons it teaches you, you know, you can't really rely on, you can't lean on anybody else. You have to sort of figure out things for yourself. And if it breaks, it's going to be really hard to figure it out. Writing quality code, that sort of set me up, I think, for a good early start to my career, for sure.
I agree. Oh man, I bet that was a beautiful, I mean, and also on top of it, like probably a really good story to tell in interviews and things too, right? So that, you know, as you're going into that, I can only imagine, I'll let you speak to it, but like I can imagine your sort of first jobs, right? They're like asking about, you know, projects you did in college and whatever. And when you can speak to this, they're probably like, whoa, okay, here's our guy, you know?
And you know, I spent a couple of months working in Bloomberg, but for me, the really first interesting job I had was working in this hedge fund, this high-frequency trading firm. Well, what's their business? It's reducing the latency of network traffic, you know, sending orders, receiving market data as much as possible. So it was kismet. You know, I was lucky to be in that place and have access to those kind of jobs. But also, I had prepared for it. It was the kind of job that was suited to me because I did all of this beforehand there too. So, yeah, it was a long payoff, but perhaps, but it really has kind of framed a lot of things since.
Yeah, gosh, I can imagine. Okay, so I like to ask folks, you know, their education, and you already alluded to it, but if you want to speak to, you know, exactly what maybe degree you were chasing down, you talked about your thesis, but just curious, you know, what that education side of things looked like.
Yep. So I went to Imperial College London, did computing there. They have it under the Faculty of Engineering rather than science. So that sort of shows you that very engineering mindset background. Most people call it computer science. Imperial is strange in many ways, and certainly in its course naming. I was going to do a master's, but I switched down to take a job at Bloomberg, realized I didn't like it, and sort of navigated that little curve in my career. So it's, you know, I really enjoyed my time there. I think it's fortunate with something like computing, computer science. I like the resourcefulness of it. You don't have to have a lot of, you know, backing. You can turn up on the first day. As long as you're prepared to read an experiment beforehand, you can make quite a bit of impact. It's the same, you know, in many other subjects, I'm sure, but in computer science, it definitely feels like that you can actually get a head start, and you know, that allows you to really dive deep into things, explore other things. And it was a, you know, I really enjoyed that. It was a good class and people who were passionate about computing. So I felt like I found my people at university. I was thankful for that.
Oh, honestly, I feel like that happens a lot, right? Like when I was a kid, I was like, I don't know. I like to say I was kind of a freak of nature, but I feel like all of us are very eccentric and different, right? So like, you know, during my day, I'd be like ripping apart a VCR and trying to figure out how the VCR is working, and then, you know, ice fishing in another moment, and then, you know, working on cars in another. So it was like I just had all these very eccentric sort of hobbies, and it was interesting to me because whenever I would spend time with people who enjoyed technology, who enjoyed coding, who enjoyed any level of taking things apart and understanding how it worked, I just was like so happy. But I'm like, these people don't like to do the things I like to do. So like how and what do I do here? And I think that's what's so interesting, right? Is like when you can find that like engineering side of it and be able to harness that and then meet the people along with it. Like I didn't go to college. It's not the way I learn. I'm like a throw me in the stuff and I'll figure it out kind of learner. And I think that's a missed opportunity, right? Is like, you know, having those fellow engineering students who think like I would, right? To sort of allow you to feel like, hey, I am normal. It's not weird that I just want to build stuff and do, you know, techie things. So I love that. I think that's finding your tribe at every stage of life, I think feels really important as a engineer
That's
generally.
true. And I think if you don't have university, then your first job is often the point where you go, okay, yeah, I taught myself a lot of things, but here is this person who's been doing it for 20 years who takes you almost up to another level there. It's fine to get a university degree, but it's great theory, but there's so much gap in practice and experience. And you come out of it thinking, oh, I'm amazing. And within 2 or 3 months of your first job, you think, gosh, there's a lot to learn. So you're sort of traveling up and down that Dunning-Kruger curve pretty quickly if you're new to this field. And the best way to do it, of course, is try and figure out what you don't know pretty quickly.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I love that. Finding out what you don't know is always the hard part, I think. Because that's the thing, right? Is like, you know, so I have so many thoughts. I'm trying to culminate them into one thought here. So developers, like obviously, as we know, we don't have an owner's manual, like a doctor that has medical licenses and protocols and regulations and things that they do and licenses that they keep up, right? They know if they're a good doctor or not. They've got a scope and a criteria behind it. Software engineers have nothing. We're just like, one of us is figuring something out, the next one's ripping it apart and driving opinions towards it and trying to make it better. And we're just, you know, trying to find our way as we go. And I think it can be a very isolating, maybe isolating is not the right word. It can be a role at which imposter syndrome can feel very natural and quick, right? And so getting out of college, going into that first role, not realizing you don't know what you're doing, can have a very overwhelming feeling of, I just went to college, I should know what I'm doing. Why do I feel so lost, you know?
Yeah, and it's a very divergent field. And I think the example that you have of the doctor's side of things, well, they have one convergent goal, which is to make people, you know, better.
Exactly.
That's all they're measured against. And if they can come up with new ways to do that, then they're an even better doctor. But for software developers, not only do you have that sense of imposter syndrome, am I good enough? That's kind of competency, but it's also that fit. Am I working on something that's actually worth working on? Or am I, on the other side of things, am I working on something that 10,000 other people have done already and have done better there too? Those are both existential worries that I think it's really easy to forget that most people do experience day to day. And if we can get competency and fit right, well, then you realize you get to the expert level, you're right at the end of the Dunning-Kruger curve, and you realize there are so many things that you won't have the chance to experience, or you need to talk to other people to find out and try and grab as much as you can from them, see what mistakes they've made to save a bit of time there too. So I totally agree with you. It kind of plays on your mind quite a bit. And I think it makes you resilient to that and to the hurdles, obviously, that you come from across in the job there too. So,
yeah, I know we could speak to like a lot of your career history and such, but I'd actually love to like dive into what you're doing today, because I think it's so applicable to what literally the conversation we're having right now of like this imposter syndrome and understanding where your skills lie and understanding sort of capabilities and where you can actually take your skills. So you're doing something pretty cool today. I'd love for you to tell the listeners or watchers what you're up to today, because I think it plays so nicely into this.
So I'm working on PureType, and that's a developer education platform that I believe has a good edge to it. It takes into context things that you're currently working on, the mistakes that you might have made, and then recommends a personalized learning journey for you. And if you can get your teammates on it, it gives you a sense of how your teammates are doing, and your manager can know that as well. So what I've seen as the limit is the books and courses, and we know developers purchase them, you know, and they invest in their own education, and often the best developers do. But there's a gap in the market, certainly, for making that something you can fit into your continuing education. Not a lot of people have hours after work, for example, but you know, they do want to improve, they do want to get better. Mm-hmm. How can you develop something that uses the few minutes they might have spare in the day to give them the one lesson that they need to learn that day? That's angle I'm really chasing down. I'm trying to build a good engaging product. If I was to reduce it down to three words, it would be Duolingo for developers, but I don't think that gives it enough credit for hopefully the context I'm going to apply to all of this and see the lessons I can learn from building ed tech and selling to developers. I've learned a huge amount already, and I hope to learn a lot more.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I can tell you right now, as someone who helps people who are targeting developers, it's a long game. It's a building of relationships and all the things which we chatted about beforehand. Yeah. But I think that's really cool, because I think, you know, there's actually been a number of guests, like Genghis was one of during the first week. So I'll just for anyone who didn't catch that one, go back. It's like episode 14 or episode 4 or 5, I think. And he really talked about this. He talked about engineering leadership and how some engineers are just they're not prone for the leadership track, right? They don't want to go and lead teams. They just want to be the best darn engineer they can ever be until they retire, right? But all the way to sort of, what does that leadership track look like? What is the other other track look like, right? As you start to go through that career ladder as a developer. And he just felt it was so incredibly important to have these plans. And he had a really beautiful word for it. And I can't recall what exactly it was, but I love how he approached it essentially. And I think that that precedent of, as developers, we really need to own our education. We need to own our career path. We really need to take a step back and actually plan that out and be methodical. Our brains are so used to thinking about the systems and to building things, right? It's we don't always necessarily take a step back and look at our career. And I think that's what he really urged developers to do, is just do that. I think that is a beautiful melding into what you're doing, right? Is like, you're taking that advice and saying, hey, let's put it to action in this platform. And this is where you can come and actually make that happen. I think that's beautiful. I'm going to pause and let you sort of reply to that. But
yeah, and I agree with him. And education and career development, I think there are two major factors that most people come across. The first is, we have such a focus as engineering teams on delivery, delivery, delivery. It's almost as if the only thing you're rated for is output and the volume of that output. And I think that's a big part of the picture, but that's not the whole picture.
Right.
So that's often the big time constraint that everybody has and what they're judged against almost. I think the second side of things is that education is one of those important but not urgent things. And we all have books that we would love to read. And, you know, we probably have some spare time of the week, but you never go, okay, I'm going to sit down and actually do that, because I know that that's a book that's been recommended a couple of times. It's important on a particular path that I'm following, that I can go and take a look and read through it and get that, you know, impart that knowledge, put it into practice. It's often like we only really invest in ourselves when we absolutely need to. Perhaps we're searching for a job, or, you know, that we're in a career transition, whereas there's nothing stopping us. We have all the technology, the kind of basis for all of this, to actually break it up into little chunks and stop sort of making excuses to ourselves of, you know, we could actually go down that individual contributor path. It doesn't stop at senior. You don't have to be an engineering manager. You know, staff and principal engineer jobs are complex. And I think that points to one of the fallacies that we have in software engineering, is we treat it like a lot of other hierarchies, where all of the leadership is actually invested in one person, like the team lead, engineering manager, lead developer. It's not actually the case. You know, as soon as you get to senior, or perhaps you're a staff or principal, at that point you are taking leadership. It might be more technical leadership, but it's still an element of, you have to go out into the unknown. No one's giving you the answers, because you're the guy that has to, you know, you're the explorer with the partially filled in map that actually has to fill stuff in there as well. And I think, of course, that's one of the great engaging things about this field, is you never stop learning. And if you do, then you're almost certainly wrong about that. You need to start, you know, filling in the map for other people to follow.
Yes. Yes. Oh, I fully agree. I mean, this bookshelf right here is probably like books that I've 50% read. Probably books I've read a chapter or two, scanned through the book, and maybe have read 25% of them, right? Like it's we want to learn the things, we want the knowledge, we want to be, you know, the best at our craft, right? And as developers, we want to do it as fast and efficient as possible. Like, that's our end goal. So we can share and be like, look what I built, as quick as possible, ideally, right? But it doesn't ask
way to learn almost. It's that sense of like, I'm going to need to know exactly what I need to know, and then I'll move on to something else there. But that's exactly a great first order thing. Like, you get something, you build it, it's cool, you get that rush. But then you could push yourself further, get that basis, and then build on top of that knowledge there too. So it's kind of interesting to see who does that and how they do it, and obviously try and help coach other people to do it as well.
Yes. Well, I think this has been what a beautiful like theme that the show has honestly started to like create all on its own, not by my direction by any means. But there's been so many conversations recently about the lack of investment into ourselves as developers, right? Like, we will go buy the book, like you said, but sometimes it sits in our desk, or we'll go buy the course. Like, you know how many courses I've bought that I like haven't actually finished, because I'm like, A, I wanted to support the developer, or B, I did fundamentally want to learn, but I just didn't prioritize the time.
Yeah.
And I think it's one of those things of like, we see those drawbacks when we get into roles, and when we're being pushed in different directions. And I've been in a situation where it's like, gosh, I really wish I would have picked up that course that I bought that I knew that I needed, but didn't actually, you know, take it to fruition. So I think that there's a major sort of precedent here of understanding, like, we are engineers and we are paid decently well. Like, we should take some of those funds that we are being paid and reinvest them back into ourselves. It's no different than a business, right? If you're starting a business, business. My dad has an auto repair business. Like, it came with a tire machine, but the tire machine really sucked. So it's like, you serve customers, buy a new tire machine when you can, right? And that's just kind of how business operates. So it's interesting that we don't do that.
Yeah, and looking at it as a system and in your tire example case, well, what's the thing that's stopping us from serving more customers or serving them better? It's that. Let's go fix that. Let's indulge that engineering mindset. That's no bad thing. And people do have educational budgets. People work at companies that allow for this kind of thing. But if you and I were to bet how much that money gets spent and the percentage of companies across the board, I think it would be a number that's a fair bit lower than 100%. And I think that's a very telling sign that even though you have those free funds available to you, you don't necessarily use all of that. You're not developing as fast as you could, I think, is a common theme there.
Yeah.
So I think with a more competitive job market, that's the kind of thing that people are starting to realize, that it's not necessarily always growing and there are more developer positions than could ever be filled. Yeah, we've been through a bit of a retractment. We've had like 25 years of solid growth. It's going to be the bottom part of the market that drops out. Fair enough, it might not be suited to them, but that means that other people still need to shape up and make sure they secure the roles or promotions they'd like to get there too. So it's nice that it all comes together in the theme of developer growth, because I know that's something you're very interested in as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, from all sides, right? It's like, at the end of the day, like, I do the job that I do because I want developers to have the experiences that they want, right? I want them to go through a product and it's like beautiful and the docs are in the main navigation and it's crystal clear how to get started. And the SDK is so stupid simple that you're like, look at me go, you know? And so for me, it's very much sort of the same end goal that you have, right? Is like, I want to see developers succeed and I want them to have that experience that they can have to be able to succeed, where you're on the other side of how can we educate and how can we level up engineers in their actual career skills and in their education to be better professionals in their role, you know? And I think it's still a beautiful synergy of developer growth for sure.
It's a very positive cycle. And I'd like to think that, you know, as PureType expands, as it supports more languages and technologies, it's freeing up managers to become more invested in career development, the software side of things, you know, allowing for that, getting rid of the mechanical, oh, you made this mistake, so go read this resource. Oh, did you get this down? I've got to follow up, etc. This stuff often gets dropped. You then leave no time for what I think is the most rewarding part of work, which is the ability for people to invest in each other's growth there. So I'm not looking to replace that whole hierarchy at all. What I'm looking to do is make sure that the human side of things actually gets the time it deserves. And well, we'll see how things go. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I love that so much. I absolutely would have loved to have focused on that as an engineering manager. I think when you're in that space, right, it's, you have so many balls to juggle, right? It's both the technical balls, you know, the business and other balls that you're juggling, right? But then you have these humans that are reporting to you that you're, you know, responsible for their career growth at which they are in your company. And I think it's not always easy to find that and to understand that. And so I love that you're doing that. I think on top of it too, there are so many different neurodiversities in technology, which I think is actually why there are so many neurodiversities is because technology is so interesting to those that have a neurodiverse brain. They get to really dive in and leverage what others may see as a disability and really bring that to life, which I think is so beautiful. But what I think is interesting is when you have those neurodiversities on teams, and that is not always easy to handle, right? Someone who, you know, needs to be in the mode, right? You know, whether that be ADHD because it's a focus or a tunnel thing, or whether that be sort of just how they think and operate and being able to work when they want to work or operate how they want to operate. And I think often, you know, in corporate culture, there isn't really this beautiful scenario for a neurodiverse or an alternative thinking type of a person. But I think when we bring it into this engineering world, there is a space for these engineering leaders to sort of understand that more deeply. And I think when you can bring that to what you're building, right, and there's actually, it's more than just a number. Yes, they did lines of code, right? It's far more than that, because someone can create a more beautiful solution versus someone else who can write more code, right? Yeah. You understand what I'm saying, but I think I think it's just interesting too when you bring that dynamic into teams as well with education.
And I think that draws upon two experiences I've had. The first is you can manage neurodiverse people well, it's at least a area that allows for that, you know, it's analysis. It's not always about making 700 calls a day. It's, well, if you think about it for 20 minutes longer, you might save an hour. It's not incredibly output focused.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, being on teams, I like this principle of decisions are discussed, then made. Mm. And it's much less of a top-down thing of decisions are made, then discussed, because you get to take the pressure off it. You just get to collect opinions from people who might otherwise sort of shy away from those kind of scenarios, and then say, well, actually, yeah, I've made the best decision because I feel like it's a mixture of all of these different points of view there. So yeah, that's the first point. The second is, you know, it's about giving people a full picture of what engineering is supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, even if you're managing a neurodiverse person, others in the business are going to think, well, okay, they're not kind of following that. There's a strong group mentality, as there should be in any company, but not everyone can be part of all of the practices of that group.
Yep.
And trying to give them a good sense of, well, this person is good, even if he doesn't follow all of the things there, or he has a bit more flexibility. That's not because he's a special exception. It's because that's the best way to get the best out of him there. And, you know, yep, they, I'm not trying to fit everybody into a single template of what a great engineering leader is supposed to be. And I guess that goes back to what we were discussing about those two paths. Is it man management? Is it technical leadership? Is it both? That's, there are a multitude of paths to follow. It's divergent. It's not convergent, I guess, to tie that particular thread up there too.
Yeah, no, I fully agree. Yeah, it's interesting too. And I think it's, I'm just thinking back, you know, to like engineering manager days, right? Or even just general like leadership days. I think that was probably the most painful thing to navigate with some of that stuff. And it was, and it's hard too, because as a manager, you're looking to advocate, right? And so the more details and insights and information you can have to sort of navigate and understand that, I think is powerful.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Love that. Okay. So let's talk a little bit more technically. Like you're building PeerType, right? It's a platform itself. So what are the underlying technical stack that you've been building in or, and on top of it, and, or what is your preferred stack to build in? But I assume it's likely the same.
So at the moment, right now, it's Elixir and Phoenix Live View. So Elixir's
very cool.
Yeah. It's a language that's gaining a fair bit of popularity. And in fact, one of the initial languages I've supported on the platform for people to learn is Elixir, because the demand is there. And if you look at the Stack Overflow survey, it says, well, people actually want to learn it, but they haven't got around to it yet. So good place to start. Also a good language to code it in. So having built that, it's great for prototyping. It's a great language to interface with other things, machine learning, the way in which it picks apart the code, for example. So it's trying not to solve all problems at once. It's almost a bit like Python on the machine learning side of things. If it needs to go down and do some numerical stuff, that's going to be some library that handles that. In this case, a lot of the platform functions a bit like a recommendation engine. I have all of these different streams of information coming in. What's the areas they should learn next, and taking that apart there too. So there's some great libraries that have come up in the last 2 or 3 years focused on things like machine learning, focused on, in this case, Phoenix Live View. It's like a server-based thing, so you don't have to write a ton of JavaScript. You can just write something in one language, get it going quickly, get the feedback that you need to go write somewhere else as well. The speed of prototyping is such a huge factor nowadays, but also the way that the language is designed, the stack is designed, means that you end up writing individual servers within the same application that keep state nicely compacted. It's almost impossible to write a code base that ends up being a complete mess with everything talking to each other after a while. It's a language I think it was a brave choice to adopt back at the previous place 5 or 6 years ago, but I think it's a sensible choice nowadays. Yeah.
That is really cool. Well, there's actually been, I'd have to go back to reference which ones, but Elixir has been mentioned twice on the show. And in both of those times, they were talking, if I recall correctly, they were referencing like something that they wanted to be diving into, but didn't have the time, honestly. So that's really interesting. I love that.
hopefully with PureType, they'll get the chance at least to pick apart some of the things, get some feedback on that. And JavaScript, TypeScript will always be around. And my plan is to support those languages next. But you can also give feedback on the individual technologies and the frameworks that people are using within the language. And you can even go further, I'm hoping, into things like software architecture. You know, you wrote all of this, but actually you should probably use this pattern if that's the case. I think that's going to be a really interesting path to travel down.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the like amazing, right? Because I think it's, there are resources to fundamentally learn languages, but like you said, there's a difference between learning that language and then taking that and actually applying that. And so when someone can learn a new language and then learn how that language works, right? That's, I think, the beauty of it is like, we can pick up a language, we can teach ourselves, we can memorize, you know, syntax and whatever, but it's actually truly understanding why that language is so powerful, why that's the one that you would want to choose and operate with, having those strong opinions, right? And then understanding how that applies into that build system. That's the good stuff that like will drive a career forward.
Yeah. And you and I, I'm sure, have been in the position where you learn a new language and then you get your first bit of your first issue assigned or your first PR and you think, okay, I could do it in one of three ways, but I need to get some feedback from somebody. Let me do it this way. Figure out the, and then you get to call it review. Oh, why did you even try that way? You should do it the second way or third way, because, and then that's the point at which they say, here are the principles. You know, you might understand all of these different things, but here's how they fit together. And here's the factors that you should be taking into account to make that particular choice there too. So that's an interesting angle. It's trying to make sure that people reach that point as quickly as possible. I think that's going to be quite interesting to go down and give that feedback.
Yes, I fully agree. Well, I'm excited. You'll have to come back on the show after you've been, you know, doing PureType for a while and catch us up on all the things that you've been up to. Yeah. Okay, so sort of thinking about some of the questions I like to ask. I'm trying to think here. We talked about your stack. How do you get unstuck? Like as you're building PureType, I mean, you're sort of, are you a team of one right now?
Team of one. And
okay.
Yeah.
That's hard.
And so it is hard. And I think it might be able to allude to the question of, well, how do you, you know, get over hurdles? How do you see past things there?
Yeah.
I'd say it's wearing multiple hats. You know, I try not to be attached to any particular piece of code I'm writing. And obviously we live in an age now where the cost of writing new code has collapsed. You no longer feel such a big attachment to, oh, well, I went down this particular path. This is going to take me hours to redo.
Thank you, AI.
It is being critical. I mean, it helps, you know, there's a review element to all of this. You do have to look at things and think, okay, well, I've written all of this, but I did it because that was the prototype. It's almost like I'm generating some good material that I would want to get feedback on later. I think it's the days, perhaps, of sitting and coding stuff for 8 hours straight have changed significantly. You know, it's much more a mixture of different parts of it. And I've always seen writing code as a nice side effect of the job. I find myself leaning a lot more on sketching stuff out on paper, getting some sense of where things are. I think the nice thing about being a bit more senior and doing this enough is to have the language to criticize the work you've done so far. It's a bit like a chef who doesn't know how to describe what they're, the food that they're tasting or the words that they have for it. If you don't have that language, it's very hard to know what's good or not. And getting that feedback from others is absolutely fundamental to that, because they're the ones who say, well, this doesn't look right. And then they draw it up into some high level principle as well. I don't know if that's the kind of techniques that you've come across there and what you found useful there too.
Yeah, no, I think that's incredibly helpful because like, you know, as developers, right? Sometimes it's hard for us to unveil the code that we wrote. Although now I feel like it's less in that way, in that now, you know, PRs and code reviews and stuff are definitely a more regular type of a operation. But, you know, like when I was learning to code, right, that wasn't a thing. Like GitHub wasn't a thing. There wasn't, you know, this ability to go look at someone's code and review it. And like, I wasn't even using Git. There was like, oh my gosh, SVN. Like SVN was where I started, you know, it was, and even that was like painful. So it's really interesting too, of like, I think now if I could go back and change things about my career start, right, is like that I think is so incredibly valuable. It's like the ability to say, hey, here's a chunk of code, here's a chunk of what I did, go look at it, go provide feedback on it, you know, do those things. And it was just not as easy to do that in the past. So yeah, I think
I'd sort of blurred that out of my mind, but yeah, when I started, it was SVN, and there wasn't a good code review platform for it. You just attached a diff to an email, and someone, if they had time, gave you feedback. To think in 10, 15 years, we've come from that prehistoric era to something where AI code review is obviously a big factor, upcoming factor in the market. That's just mad that we could have ever learned from those kind of processes.
Honestly, now that you say it like that, wow, that is really like 15 years. That's real fast for that to happen, truly. Yeah. Because like, not only did we not have peer reviews, like you said, but now we've got computer peer reviews and human peer reviews and all the possible reviews. Do you think, I don't know, gosh, like, it just makes me wonder, like, I really can't speak to what it's like to learn to dive into technology anymore, because it was just such a different world that we came from. And how the evolution and how fast it's grown is like actually truly remarkable when you think about it.
It was a shakier start. It was harder. Things like REPLs didn't exist 15, 20 years ago. You just had to code up something, compiled it, and hoped it worked. This is in danger of turning into a back in my day conversation, but that the cycle of, you know, getting that first bit of satisfaction. And I think that first moment of, oh, cool. If that's the rewarding part for any future developer, then that's the thing. That's the feeling you've got to latch onto and aim for in the future. That's something which at least you can experiment a bit more. We're almost as if we're becoming less in, you have to have an engineering mindset and more a scientific mindset. I'm going to experiment with this. I'm going to see if it works. I'm going to try and collect some feedback on why that is and why it's not necessarily the best solution. And I think that can only be a good thing. I think we should accept a bit more failure as part of our job as software engineers almost.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I love that. I love that so much because there's just so much to it. Right. Man, I'm like, I feel like I could pull this open even deeper, but I'm like time. Okay. So how about like you in your own, you know, work, are you in terms of like, yes, capturing feedback, super important, what have you, do you have a team of people that you reach out to them, like a circle that you're like, hey, I'm working by myself. Like, can you review my code? Can you review what I'm up to? Like, how do you go about that being a team of one?
So it's almost as if I leave the code review to myself. So I don't know what kind of horrors I'll unleash for anybody who looks at the code base one day. You know, we're often blind in that sense. What I found useful is at a higher level, is it worth building this feature? You know, why? What's the feedback that I'm getting? What have other people done in the past? And you know, I've worked with an advisor, a couple of advisors, the sort of people who've done it before, but they've done it to slightly different angles. It might be security scanning. That's still a case of, is this code good? Why isn't it good?
For sure.
In that case, the goal is, well, it has a security vulnerability. My goal is, well, there's a big gap between the code that you could write and the code that you have. And I think here's where the areas that you need to firm up on are, the language that you're starting to speak. I found that to be more a lot more productive. And then you get some of the educational guys, the sort of people who have done this, you know, it might be for in high school or for college courses, instructional design, all these sorts of people who I think edtech people never talk to, but they have very strong opinions on how things work, how people learn, how people forget, and the kind of questions that you should be asking to get them up to speed there too. So for me, that's over the last couple of months, it's been great to talk to people, job titles, for instance, I didn't even realize existed, and really talk about things at a high level. And maybe that's the way software engineering is going, that we are becoming more product engineers. We're becoming a bit more attached to each discipline, but we're using the skills I think software engineering has given us to pick apart those areas, find out those principles, and become a lot more adept at in every domain there too. And I think in the fields that I've been in before, fintech and finance, there's been a strong value in actually learning, you know, what this product is or this contract, how it behaves there too. It's been nice to speak those languages as well as write code there too. I haven't felt like that I was not becoming a software engineer. I just felt like I was learning additional stuff that also indulged you know, engineering, learning, all the things that I'd like to do. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Well, I feel like, you know, when you're in some of those like really niche industries, and like fintech definitely falls into that, like healthcare is another one that sort of falls into that, obviously very regulated. But there's a lot that you learn just because when you're operationally building, right, you start to understand the industry itself. Like, how does the fintech APIs work? I hear some of them are archaic, right? I haven't actually directly worked for a bank to have to work with some of those different sort of endpoints and things. I've heard the brutal stories though. Mine was a more cutting edge side when I was in fintech, but it's really interesting too, to dive into that. And I think that's also been some good, you know, premise that has come from various conversations that just, again, feeds back into what you're building with PeerType is like how important it is to actually like help and engage one another and to really dive in to have those conversations. Good follow-up question for you. And I'm sure like you'll have a variety of different answers here, but as you're starting to meet those people that you've never talked to before, job titles you've never seen before, how are you finding those people? Like, are you just LinkedIn scrolling? Are you asking folks to do introductions? What's your path there?
I think it's both. And I think, yes, LinkedIn, much maligned in terms of the quality of the feed, but you can always unfollow people there. But the fact that you can connect to all these people that you have in common means that you can grow your network a lot more than you ever could virtually. And for me, physically, having moved to a new city, Montreal, it's great to get started in that and trying to pick through that and talking, going to CTO meetups. Well, they're all have an engineering focus to them. They're all interested at least to see where things are going there. So I think LinkedIn is the first thing to go to. I think second is following the intro chain. And I'm saying not just, oh, you talk to this guy, but you ask him, oh, is there anybody else in your network I should be talking to? And there was some where I thought, oh, this is a nice conversation, but it's not really going anywhere. You know, that overlap isn't there. Fair enough. Not everything works out. But then the intro to me to somebody who goes, oh, this is exactly the kind of thing that I'm you know, really, really quite handy with. You know, I'd really like the opportunity to do that. And actually following three or four people deep, that's, again, it's, I think that's one of been a great experience as a founder, and has brought me out of I need to be focused on this. You know, there's this product release coming up. There's I need to make sure that this is as good as possible to a more divergent. Okay, there's 100 different people I could talk to, but who's going to care the most at this point, and who's going to help shape the direction that I've been seeing hundreds of hours building the right thing for? And it comes down to that output metric of I could write all, sit down and write all of this, but no sole founder is going to have the sort of resilience to do that. How can I use my time most effectively, and how can I talk to people to do that? So could I have done that in the same way 10 years ago? No, not really. You know, people weren't as engaged on LinkedIn. They weren't open to as many conversations. I think we are becoming a more collaborative world. I think in terms of these types of conversations, perhaps you and I wouldn't have met 5 or 10 years ago, sadly. And within companies themselves, we're realizing that software engineering is quite a team sport. You know, yes, it's kind of practice individually, but it's becoming more and more a practice as a group. So, you know, mob programming, pairing, all of those practices are becoming a lot more efficient and easier to do asynchronously, et cetera, than they ever were a few years ago. Yeah.
Yes, I agree. Honestly, like, you know, sometimes it's like there are some, we can argue social media, right? And it's goodness that it has brought to the world versus the negativeness that it has brought to the world. Yeah. But I do think that LinkedIn has been one of the really beautiful things to be able to just connect and network with people in that way, in more of that professional sense, which I think has been something beautiful to really do that. Because like you said, I don't think we would have met, right? Like, as I look at sort of our crossings and wherever, it was a very serendipitous sort of meeting of, you know, someone introducing there in that way. So, I mean, we think about it, right? And like, gosh, okay. So I love the TV show Friends. Like, I love the show. So I swear this isn't a tangent. I'm not going way off course here, but we were rewatching it. And right now we're like in season 8 or something. Right. But we've been rewatching it sort of just kind of is like in the background. My husband loves to watch TV. Long story short, it's just even interesting to sort of like watch old shows like that, right? In the beginning, they didn't even have cell phones and they're like, oh, like Ross gets a pager because his like ex-wife is going to have a baby or something, you know? And it's just interesting to sort of think back to like that world at which we had to be like leaving voicemails on people's home phone voicemails to be like, hey, can I intro you to a friend? Like, it's just so much harder to just say, hey, I know somebody, let me connect you to them, because the path at which to communicate with someone was a lot more difficult, you know?
Well, it's a bit like cyberpunk and that whole genre, and the fact in the Victorian era, we built the first internet, we could have basically real-time transmission across the Atlantic, but we still had horses for that. And trying to figure out, okay, you know, our speed of communication, what we could actually do with that communication. It's these two big factors that were always playing a part. I feel like we've made a huge leap in communication over the past couple of years, and now we're trying to figure out, well, how do we work together using that and make use of it there too? And obviously LLMs, AI just fit into that a fair bit.
Yep, I agree. I know now we have like too many communication paths. It's like, do you want me to text you or Twitter DM you or send you a message on LinkedIn or email you? Or I could call you. all the ways. This has been such a lovely conversation. Where can folks... Great. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Where can folks find you? Obviously PeerType, but let us know the URL directly so that folks can go find that directly. And then any, you know, places where they can meet with you or get to know you.
Yeah, so it's puretype.ai, .ai because it was the cheapest domain name suffix. It does use a bit of AI as well. And love I'm that. At puretype.ai, but I'm always on LinkedIn. DM me there. I'm always happy for a chat. I know how hard it is to get that initial network going, and I like software development, I like learning, I like any intersection of the two, so I'm sure I will get around to answering any messages that you end up sending.
Oh, I love that so much. I think, you know, like we talked about this a little in the pre-show, but it's like us developers and software engineers, we just want to hang out with our tribe. Like we want to get to know each other. We want to spend time together, have these kinds of conversations. So absolutely encourage folks to reach out to Matt. It's been fabulous meeting you, like absolutely fabulous. You have done some super cool stuff. I'm excited to dive into PeerType. Other developers, I know there are a lot of earlier to mid to late career developers that can really benefit from PeerType. So I hope that folks get that message and they check it out as well. So
yeah, it's been lovely to meet and chat, and I'm hoping to we'll keep in contact and maybe appear on the show sometime soon. Let's see how it all works out.
Yes, absolutely. Honestly, I should bring you on and we can talk about it later, but on the Built for Devs Hub, I'm just trying to bring together like great, beautiful, meaningful conversations. So it'd be great to bring you in there and maybe you can talk about sort of why you built PeerType and, you know, sort of the backbone behind it, at least in terms of like developers needing to learn and, you know, all the reasons why they should dive into investing in their own education.
Exactly. Oh, that'd be great.
Awesome. Okay, well, I hope everyone has a fabulous rest of their day. I'll see you all again tomorrow. Matt, have a lovely day as well.
Same to you. Cheers.
Cheers.